Hey everybody, today's episode is sponsored by Penzu, your personal journal in the cloud. Penzu is where millions of people keep their most private thoughts, all locked with a secret password. Go to penzu.com, that's spelled P-E-N-Z-U now, and sign up for a free account. For extra security and fun customizations, go to penzu.com/GoPro on your computer and use promo code Radical for $5 off your Pro or Pro Plus subscription. Once again, that's promo code Radical. Now let's get to the show.
This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode 24. Today's episode, we're actually going to, it's launching on August 29th, and September is actually Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. And we're kind of doing, I guess, a kind of a special episode in some ways. I'm going to be talking about my recent prostate cancer scare today with our guest, Dr. Crystal Clark, who's that's kind of her area of research. But I had a recent event where I was having some problems and some pains, and ended up in the doctor and found out that I was that it was suggested that I get a prostate biopsy to check for cancer. And fortunately for me, it came up negative. I'm going to have to, I think from this point on, though, kind of stay on top of it and keep it, keep a good close eye on it. It's just kind of how that thing goes. But I'm really excited to, you know, kind of come out with that, in some ways, come out with that experience with my friend and colleague, Dr. Clark. So we can kind of maybe make more people aware about this kind of thing. Prostate cancer can be pretty terrible. Each year, more than 20, according to the Prostate Cancer Foundation, PCF.org, more than 29,000 men will die of this disease each year, and it is the second leading cause of cancer cause of cancer death in men. But if diagnosed early, the 5-year survival rate is almost 100%. And actually, if diagnosed early, the 10-year post-diagnosis, actually 98% of men diagnosed early remain alive. So it's really about getting the word out, getting men to get over the fears of screening and go out and do it. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And I've actually been meaning to talk to today's guest, Dr. Clark, for some time, initially about her involvement with organization, a nonprofit organization that she's involved with called Girls with Roots, which is a Caribbean nonprofit organization geared toward empowering and mobilizing Caribbean girls and women to become exemplary leaders of tomorrow, and also serve as a platform to facilitate discourse on the very issues that affect Caribbean women. And this nonprofit seeks to build a momentum and awareness that allow women to realize their uniqueness, their Caribbean roots. So, but now we have a couple things to talk about. Her research around prostate cancer screening in Black men, and her work with Girls with Roots. And also get to share my experience with her and just catch up. It had been a while since I've talked with Dr. Clark. We met originally in our respective PhD programs. We ended up sitting next to each other in a class and have been friends ever since. And so it's really nice to get a chance to talk with her again. So I'm just going to get right into it. I'd like to maybe just introduce our guest, Dr. Clark. Crystal Renee Clark has completed a few degrees. She has a bachelor's in science and behavioral sciences. She has a master's of science in marital and family therapy, and she has a doctor of philosophy in family studies from Loma Linda University, where I attended as well. She has also attended the 51st United Nations Graduate Study Program held in Geneva in 2013. And at that conference, she worked as part of the United Nations Population Fund Working Group and co-developed a program proposal entitled Reducing Sexual and Gender-Based Violence Among Adolescent Girls and Boys in a Post-Emergency Situation in Haiti, a United Nations Population Fund Facilitated Analysis on Gender Equality and the Empowerment of Women. Dr. Clark has extensive experience in quantitative and qualitative methodology, analysis, and presentation. She has worked in a collaborative team on the National Institute of Health, and a National Institute of Health funded project called Project Change in the United States of America. Project Change focused on assessing the relationship between stress and prostate cancer in Black men. And also, she serves as a clinical training coordinator of the Transitional Support Services at the Behavioral Health Institute at Loma Linda. Well, she served as that. And Dr. Clark conducts research to identify community needs in an effort to plan, implement, monitor, and evaluate life skills program for at-risk children and youth. Dr. Clark is currently an associate professional with the United Nations Development Program in Trinidad and Tobago, and she also lectures at the Universities of the Southern Caribbean and volunteers, of course, with a nonprofit organization called Girls with Roots. So without further delay, let's meet Dr. Crystal Clark. Okay, welcome to the show, Dr. Clark.
Thank you, Dr. Haas. Thank you for inviting me. Yes.
It's really great to be talking to you again. It's, you know, when did you move back to Trinidad and Tobago?
I actually moved back a year ago. So I moved back 2015 in the month of June. It was just about a few days after graduation.
Okay, yeah. So it's probably been about a year since I've really, a little over a year since I've had a conversation with you. So
yeah,
it's very nice to be doing it again.
Definitely.
Okay, so for our audience, I guess I should kind of maybe tell them how we met. We met, I guess we ended up sitting next to each other in Dr. Curtis Fox's Advanced Family Theory, right, class?
Advanced Family Studies, yes.
Yeah, so, and I was getting a PhD in Marriage and Family Therapy, and you were getting a PhD in Family Studies, and that's how we came to know each other. And then I guess we did some work together on, I'm forgetting the name of the student.
SACS, Student Advisory Committee.
Yeah. Where we did student retreat and stuff like that. So
yes, and planned professional development projects and whatnot. Yeah, wow, you're bringing back good memories.
Good, I'm glad you feel that way. Yeah, because it was fun times, and it was fun times. So anyway, so for our audience, before we get rolling and talking about several different things, but I thought maybe if you could share with us a little bit about your background, how you came to the state, you know, your education, how you came to the States, or whatever you think is important about how your journey to where you're at currently.
Great. So as you mentioned earlier, I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, which is a country in the Caribbean. It's actually two separate islands, and I'm from the smaller of the two islands. And I completed most of my schooling here. So I went through what we call primary school, then secondary school, and I did my undergrad as well in Trinidad with a school with it's called University of the Southern Caribbean, and was actually affiliated with Andrews University in Michigan. While at school there, we had a few persons from Loma Linda University in California. They came to USC and to promote the school and talking about the different programs. Around the same time, I think I was enrolled in a drug abuse class, and just talking about drugs issues and addiction, and recognizing that one of the best ways to treat with that issue was a systemic view or a systemic approach. And so just hearing about systemic approach and marriage and family therapy and being introduced to that, and then Loma Linda offering that, I said, huh, that kind of, you know, piqued my interest. And then I started stalking Loma Linda's website. From then, I told you, I stalked it. I would be looking at their graduation thing and just kind of saying, wow, I'd really like to go there. But I didn't think it would be possible because it's far, far away in this wonderful place where, you know, movie stars live.
Yeah, right.
And whatnot. But through undergrad, I was able to finish school with a decent GPA, a really good GPA, and that allowed me to receive a scholarship. So I got a scholarship from the government and was able to go to this dream school and pursuing marriage and family therapy. Now, while at the program there, I recognized that I had more of an interest in family life education, and well, I definitely wanted to do some more research. So that's when I moved. So when I graduated from the master's, I decided I'll move over to family studies. I think it would have been helpful for me to have the therapy background and also the educational background, and so, then go that way.
Yeah, what was it about family studies that, I guess, appealed to you over, say, traditional family therapy?
I looked at my interests and I kind of reflected on my experience with family therapy, and I recognized that family therapy is... how to explain that? It was a really great tool to help persons, and I enjoyed the systemic area, aspect of it. But for some reason, I couldn't see myself doing traditional therapy for most of my days. I saw myself seeing one or two clients, but I enjoyed the whole workshop experience, the group presentations, making presentations in front of groups, doing research more so on how to teach family issues and how to deal with human development issues. And I felt like family studies would have been a more appropriate way to get that training. I didn't necessarily want to continue with the traditional therapy, so to speak. I didn't feel as though... I kind of compared myself with other classmates, and I saw the drive and the when they're talking about the philosophy of it all and how exciting they were, and I didn't really have that same interest. I had a really great interest in learning more about families and family issues, but not from a therapy perspective, more of a prevention type education perspective.
Sure, and I imagine you found it probably maybe a little isolating for you since...
To be honest, I kind of felt different at times. And I don't think it was anything to do with the way that the program was structured, but it was just my interest. I didn't get the sense that, you know, I think the training was definitely helpful and I'm happy I did it and it would... I use the skills still today. But to the traditional therapy thing, I didn't get that strong connection or that I didn't feel at home, so to speak.
So then, we've been talking. I guess I should just say we've been talking about having this conversation for a few months now. So and then finally it's happened. And one of the things that I think kind of really made it happen was that a few things, but one is that, you know, your research, which we'll get into in a second, was around prostate cancer in Black men. And I had this recent kind of prostate cancer scare. I started to experience some pain, and it wasn't going away, and I got concerned. So I ended up which I normally would do is not go to the doctor, but I ended up going to the doctor, right? And ended up being diagnosed with prostatitis, and then gave me some antibiotics and that went away, but then my labs came back bad, and it was suggested I get a biopsy, and so I had to go through all of that, and that quite honestly is not the greatest experience, and so but And we're also coming into September, which is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. So yes. I think this conversation is a great way to kind of maybe bring some attention to that as well and to the yes. to the need for screening. But can you maybe share with us how you came to pick your, because you go into a PhD program, it's in family studies, and then you're going to have to do a dissertation, right? And how did you come to this area of research? What interested you about it, or what personal experiences did you have that brought you to this place?
Right. Great question, Chris. And I'm happy that you eventually went to the doctor and got checked. And to me, as you know, September is approaching and prostate cancer awareness is celebrated or recognized rather in September. Mm-hmm. I really want to commend you for that, because as you mentioned, you're not the only one. Many men express having a challenge with going to the doctor when something seems quote unquote wrong. Mm-hmm. Regarding my research interest, I had a prostate cancer situation in my family. My grandfather passed from prostate cancer. Mm. He suffered for quite some time. And actually, what was a bit disturbing for me is that I started the program, the PhD program, and shortly after, about a few months into it, he passed away. And actually, just a few weeks or so before that, I learned that he had prostate cancer. I thought that he just had prostate issues. My family didn't really go into too much detail about his condition. And so it was kind of it hit me really hard when, you know, I found out that he had it and then shortly after he passed away. And so from that, just, I had so many questions. Being a family member, being a part of the system and having many questions and wondering why was I left out and what could I have done to, you know, to assist. And so my mind just, you know, went in so many different places. I was trying to figure out, you know, what do the family members go through when the patient is diagnosed or is surviving cancer or going through treatment. You know, because sometimes we focus on the patient and we don't recognize how this illness may affect other persons in the system. Mm. I also was trying to figure out if there's any way that us as family members could assist patients, because my grandfather was suffering for about 10 years.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, he was suffering for quite some time, and that he actually lived to a pretty decent age. He lived till I think 81. Mm. So, you know, it wasn't that bad. And so that all these questions came to me, and then I had a colleague who was doing research in that area, and I was like, great, let's collaborate, and let's see, you know, what we could do. So, I mean, I had so many different drafts of my research question and whatnot, but eventually it was looking at intimacy. So looking at prostate cancer screening intentions among Black men and looking at how intimacy influenced Black men to get screened. And I focused particularly on Black men because Black men were most likely to be diagnosed with prostate cancer. They're also most likely to have aggressive forms of cancer, and they're most likely to pass away at a younger age. Wow. But they're also most likely to not get screened. So there's so many issues. They're likely to get this thing, get it bad, and die. But they're also less likely to get screened. And the more you read about prostate cancer is that if you catch it at an early stage, then you're likely, the survival rate is pretty, pretty good.
So what did you find, or what were your thoughts about, you know, I have some ideas about, you know, men and getting prostate screening and how it gets talked about and that kind of thing. But what did you find about, what were the factors or contextual factors that kind of limited screening or?
Right. So in the literature search, and we also did some qualitative, some focus groups with the women, and then also some informal conversation with the men while we, so actually let me backtrack.
Sure.
we collected the data from California and from New York. And how we did that is through health fairs. Now, let me also put a plug in here for research and research in Black men, because in the literature, you might read that it's difficult to get access to African-Americans or Black persons to participate in research because of the Tuskegee study or different studies that went bad where, you know, they were exploited. And what we recognize is that we had a really big sample size, well, relatively, right, because big is relative, but we had a decent sample size when we...
Yeah, I think when I read it, it was near 500 people, right?
Yeah, we had about 500 and I think two persons, but we fleshed it down to 770 for my study.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, sorry, 470.
Okay.
470, yeah, for my study, which is pretty decent because when you read the other studies on prostate cancer and Black men, the sample size would be smaller than that. Yeah. And so we had a decent size. And what we recognized, even with our health fair approach, is that when you build relationships with these men, they're more likely to trust you and they're more likely to participate in what you're doing. Hmm. Building relationships would include educating them on what you're being involved in, going to their community. So we went into their churches, we went to the barber shops, we went to them and kind of bring them out to participate in the in the study. That's and we great. Also gave incentives. So we had incentives to, I think we had gift cards to
pretty,
encourage.
Pretty standard.
to encourage the men to come. Because we recognize that this is a population that we don't really get to tap into because of all the challenges in the past. Hmm. And I think we were very successful in that vein. So that's one of the things that we learned in terms of research with that population, that it's very possible, but relationship is key. And that actually leads to my finding, because what I used as my theory was sort of an ecological theory. So I was looking at the different levels in society. So we looked at intimacy, which was how close the men felt with a significant other. And we also looked at, I think, education. I'm just going to pull it up right here.
Oh, sure.
Right. So we looked at age. We looked at ethnicity and how we did the ethnicities, comparing men or African-American men who were born in the United States compared to men who migrated to the United States from Africa or the Caribbean. Because what we recognize is that there might be a slight difference in rates. Men from Jamaica seem to have a higher incidence compared to men from African America, the African American men rather, so men who were born in the United States. Hmm. So we wanted to use that as a proxy for culture. However, you know, there are limitations with that because we didn't have information on how long they were, well, we did have information, but I didn't use that for my study, on how long they were in the United States for. Sure. Because that might have done something, you know, if you were there for 1 year compared to probably 10, 20 years, then the level of acculturation might not be the same. And that's something to look at too. How much does the United States influence
screening?
Their view on screening. Because part of it is their view. One of the things that we also looked at is their view on screening and their intention to screen. That was actually your outcome variable. Mm-hmm. What was your intention? So not necessarily if they screened or not, but their intention to get screened. Because we also note that some men might screen once and never screen again. Mm-hmm. Another thing is that we had a lot of younger men as well who were what we call in the pre-screening age. So we wanted to get a sense from a younger age if they are intending to screen at all because of their risk. They're at a higher risk than an average man. So they need to be thinking about screening even though they're younger, even though they're 21, 22.
So how did they talk about, did they have intentions of being screened or?
What we recognized is that men were more likely to get screened if they felt close with their significant other.
Interesting.
Yeah. So when we did the models, we saw, yeah, you know, they're not significant, but the moment we put in intimacy, and actually when we put intimacy in, we recognized that there was a difference between African-American men and Caribbean men or immigrant black men. Mm. When we put intimacy in, we recognized that Caribbean or immigrant black men were more likely to get screened or more likely to intend to screen for prostate cancer, possibly suggesting that immigrant persons kind of value intimacy or take that into consideration when they're thinking about getting screened. And, you know, there are several things you could think about with that. You could think, well, maybe because they're not from there, then they, you know, they're in a new place, then they need, you know, more support emotionally. Yeah. Or you could also assume that perhaps the culture of the Caribbean person or the African person might be more of a tight-knit emotional type of support compared to a person from the United States, or specifically a black person from the United States. Yeah. So for me as a family studies a practitioner, for the want of a better word, mm-hmm. I got really interested in the fact that intimacy played a role.
Right.
Because we are family, we are all interested in relationships, right?
Right.
We are all about relationships, and we recognize how important it is for, say, mental health or emotional health, but we're recognizing that it can also be helpful for public health and just your physical health
right. In
general. And that is important because we, as in the world, we should be moving towards the whole collaboration and integration of different fields, like multidisciplinary work. Mm. That is what we should be moving towards instead of dealing with things in silos. So yeah, the medical doctors are doing their thing,
yes. And
the social workers are doing their thing. No, we should all find a way to come together and treat individuals or families with different challenges and issues in today's society.
Totally agree. And so you finish your research, and I'm wondering, did you start going, what are your thoughts about how to kind of take away this, I want to call it fear of screening, or, you know, this kind of resistance to screening or whatever it may be, but did you start to go out and do educational projects or what have you?
Actually, I had linked, when I returned home, I linked with the Cancer Society in Trinidad and Tobago.
Oh, wow.
And one of the concerns, no matter where you go, apparently, what the concern is the whole screening thing.
Yeah.
And having conversations with the coordinator there, you know, I was just informing her of what I've done so far and letting her know that targeting the females might be helpful. So, yes, we would try to get the men to come, but I think if you want the men to come, you should target their significant other.
Wow, interesting.
Educate the women out there or the men out there who are close to these men that you're trying to target. Educate them about the issue and have them bring the guy.
Yeah.
And so we had conversations about that. Another thing that I'm going to start doing is visiting the cancer support group.
Hmm.
There's a cancer support group here. And I was trying for the longest while to get connected with them, and I finally have information. So that should be next Thursday that I'll be visiting, just to see how I could support in that way. But in my little corner, I use my Facebook to really... Hold one second.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that. No. The woes of using your phone for Skype.
So you're near your corner.
In my little corner. Thank you. In my little corner on my Facebook, I try to promote prostate cancer awareness.
Yes.
And especially the month and a little information about prostate cancer and whatnot. And I try to Well, immunized.
That's what reminded me to reach out to you too.
Yeah.
We are Facebook friends, so I was like, oh, yep, Crystal.
Great. So yeah. I'm happy it's doing something, because media is a great way to spread the news. Everyone's on Facebook now, Snapchat, whatever.
Yep.
So might be surprised. And I have friends from all over. Look, I have you as a friend, and you're in Cali.
Yep.
And so, you know, it can be wide reaching.
For sure.
And I also try to, you know, speak with the people around me, like the males in my life, to help them recognize how important it is. Regarding the fear, Chris, I don't know if... I think it's more about working around the fear than trying to dispel the fear, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
Because, you know, it can be a scary thing. But part of it is also education. Because some men fear the digital rectal
yes.
exam.
Yes.
They need to recognize now that it's not only that. You could do a PSC. So part of it is education, working around that fear, trying to figure out what exactly their thoughts are about it and how can you educate or encourage them to find out what is interesting, what is important to them. So if virility is important to them and being able to still use their penis, if that's important,
right.
Letting them know that, hey, if you want to keep using your arm, if you want to still be virile.
Have an active sex life, right?
Exactly.
Yep.
Then, you know, go get checked and talk with your doctor. Because one of the challenges with, you see, prostate cancer has a huge controversy because on one end, there's a community saying that, you know, men shouldn't get screened. If you live long enough, you'll get prostate cancer.
Yep,
I've heard that.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, many people would have it and it will be dormant. It will never get aggressive. And then there's the other camp that's saying, you know, you should get screened. And I think it's important to be clued in the controversy and recognize that there are gaps in the camp that says, you know, you shouldn't get screened. The gaps are that, you know, most of the studies don't include those black men who get the more aggressive cancer.
Good point. Yep.
Exactly. So it's important for persons to know their risk based on their ethnicity, based on if they had family members in who had cancer, and based on their age. You need to know what your risk factor is and act accordingly. And it's important to have a physician who would allow for you to have that agency to decide on what you want to do. Because another thing I'm reading also is that a study found that in terms of treatment choice, they're recognizing that the physician's choice trumps what the patient wants. And I don't think that's not right in essence. I think a physician at the end of the day should allow a patient to have the agency to decide on what treatment he or she wants after they have all the information.
Yep.
But I think that's basically it. Education. And apart from that, helping men foster stable and healthy relationships, so that they have the support they need to get so they could go and get screened. Because may I just pry in your business for a bit?
Sure.
Did your significant other have any...
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, I hate to admit it too. She just called me today to make another... Because I've had like six... This is the truth. I've had like six biopsies in the last year. Five of them were skin and... one was prostate, and so she just called me from the dermatologist's office saying I hadn't, chastising me because I hadn't been there in a year and saying, you need to get here. And she actually made the appointment for me, and I know that's terrible for to admit that to my wide-reaching audience. I knew where you were headed with that question, but absolutely. And that's why your research is like, yeah, it's right on as far as I'm concerned, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? It shows that you're human and it shows that despite the fear that you have, you were still able to get it done.
Yeah.
And we're not islands, you know, we all need each other in different ways. And so at least you have that support. And how do we help persons out there who might not have that support, or who might not even know how to foster. Yeah. Because that's my issue with some men. They don't know how to foster close or emotional, intimate relationships.
Right.
And it's harming them in the long run, health-wise.
Great point. You know? And that's our work, right? I think a lot of my work, maybe, and not that I'm all the time the best example of it, but how do we have men relate to each other in different ways than, you know, yes, we're kind of socialized, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Right. So I think, yeah, your research really resonated with me and that intimacy part and having that play a profound effect on me even getting screened, right? And so,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it could probably even extend to other ethnicities. You know, it's not just black men.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Okay. So wonderful. And you finished, and now you're back home. And one of the reasons we were going to talk several months ago was you became involved with Girls with Roots, and founded, I think, by your friend Charlie Ann St. Cyr. Did I say that right? From St. Lucia. Okay.
Yes.
And this is real, and you know, that captured my attention as well. It seemed like a really interesting thing that you were doing, and I wanted to kind of ask you about it, and now I got you. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about Girls with Roots?
Sure. And actually, let me put a shameless plug
sure, of course.
Out there. You can check out our website at girlswithroots.org. So it's girlswithroots.org. So girlswithroots.org, and check out our website. Yeah. It is a gorgeous website.
And I will actually link it too in all our social media stuff so they have access to it.
Yeah. Thank you. It's really pretty. So Girls with Roots is a nonprofit organization geared towards the empowerment of Caribbean girls. So it is not just a black girl community. Most persons hear roots and they think, African roots. And it's not that. It's just rooted in your Caribbean-ness. And it came out of my colleague, my friend. We've been friends for about 10 years. We went to the same undergrad. We were roommates, all that jazz. And she, early last year, she sat there and thought, hey, you know, she wants to start export the Caribbean culture because she's recognizing that slowly but surely we're becoming very Americanized in the Caribbean. And she wanted to be able to have us embrace who we are. And she felt that if she was able to export the true Caribbean-ness, so to speak, then persons would be attracted to it and they would want to know more. And then also women or girls would be empowered and recognize that they are beautiful or powerful in their own right, that you don't necessarily need to be someone else to be pretty or to be smart or to be successful. So that was kind of the premise that she had. And Girls with Roots basically focus on three areas. There are three areas of focus: identity development, personal development, educational development, and skills training. So most of our events or projects are geared towards one of those three areas. And so last year, I think you saw a bunch of posts from me.
I did.
Yeah, regarding the pretty powerful conference. So last year we had about two conferences, one in Trinidad and one in Tobago, called the Pretty Powerful Conference. And in that conference, we had we explored various topics, particularly branding. Branding is huge right now. Your Facebook presence, your Instagram presence, your in-person presence is huge. And being consistent no matter where you go to be able to, you know, be true to your brand. We spoke about that. We also dealt with conflict resolution and trying to combat the whole bullying issue that we're seeing today. Well, it was always there, but now we have a fancy term for it, I guess. So, because in the Caribbean, we didn't call it bullying before. We used to just say people were, I guess, misbehaving. But now we have a term to be able to, that we could describe what's happening. Right. So we did the whole conflict resolution training as well. We had training on, or actually we had someone come in and speak about non-traditional careers for women. That person was from Antigua, and she is a pilot / airplane engineer / drag racer / model.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, so in essence, she could rule the world, I guess.
Yeah, right.
So we had women who were really chatting the course in their various fields, come in and speak with the young girls and provide some sort of mentorship, because again, relationship is key. And if we want to help the young persons of today, one of the ways to do that is to build relationship with them and educate them and show and help them recognize how we were able to get things done, and that you're able to do it as well. Because one of the challenges in the Caribbean is exposure. Like, I would tell persons, you know, I didn't know about occupational therapy or speech therapy when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And so, but in the United States, I feel like the sky is the limit, and you get exposed, or some persons get exposed to many different things. And so we wanted to also provide exposure, open the mind, take these young girls from outside of this limited box that they think they're in, but also embrace who they are, embrace their accent, and embrace their features, and export that to the world.
Yeah, that's great. So, and and like you said, it is a very beautiful website, listener, so please go check it out. And you have a campaign up right now, which I thought was interesting. It was the hashtag I'm Not My Stereotype, and
yes,
which was kind of this you know, trying to kind of anti-labeling thing. And there's some great photos of different women with different posters of different sayings. And I just thought it was really, it was really great.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate your kind words. Yeah, we really, the stereotype thing, and that's part of the whole identity development and helping women recognize that it's okay if you don't feel or think the same way as someone else. You know, you are unique and beautiful. And when I say beautiful, I mean valued in your own right. Mm-hmm. And we had that campaign because, especially coming out of Charlie Ann's experience. So Charlie Ann, just a little bit about the founder. Sure. She is from Saint-Lucia, and she is of a dark complexion. Mm. Now, St. Lucia, the average St. Lucian that I know, at least, of a lighter complexion. And she actually grew up with a lot of people who have lighter complexion. And so she, for a huge part of her life, felt kind of displaced, kind of ugly, and had a few labels of her own that she had to dispel. And coming out of that and our own experiences of, for example, I run from time to time, and sometimes I'm faster than men. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, so people might be like, oh, is she a man? You know, different things. But just recognizing that you could be good at what you do, or you could be different, and you don't need to live up to these stereotypes that people place on you because of fear or ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know, embrace who you are. So yeah, we had really a good turnout for the photo shoot, and persons really appreciated the campaign. Because on the other side, the flip side too, we want to help persons recognize that you don't need to belittle others to be able to succeed. You know, find positive ways to engage with your peers, because oh, I tell you, and I think it's the same in the States. Here, they love to just say negative. Oh, gosh, don't touch me. Don't watch me. Why you think? You know, that tough love is the name of the game here.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, tough love. It's tough love. I hate you. Don't talk to me. That is how people say, you know, you're my friend.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. So, that's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. So
okay.
We just want to encourage persons to be positive and encourage each other, because relationships are important.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing that. And before I let you go, I wanted to talk, because we were talking before we turned on the recorder, right? And so you were talking about your experience post-graduation, and I just finished as well, and I'm, you know, out finding my way, and I know you've had that experience. So I'd be curious just to ask you, how are you navigating this post-graduation? You moved back home after being in the States for a while, and what kind of experiences are you having?
I would just say that it was quite the experience moving back.
Really?
The experience. Yeah, because, you know, you think you're from here, this is your home. I used to visit once a year most of the times. But I just felt out of place. I was away for 6 years. I was in the States for 6 years, and kind of got used to Walmart being open 24 hours a day and not having access to that. Now it's depressing to some degree. But it was an adjustment. On a serious note, I had that reverse culture shock. One, my accent. So the weird thing is, in California, I don't sound American.
Nope.
But in Trinidad and Tobago, I don't sound Trinidad and Tobagonian.
Really?
So, yeah. It's like I created this whole new accent.
That did you know it was happening?
I didn't know. Okay. I honestly don't even remember what I sounded like before. That's like an identity kind of.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely like a whole identity thing. I don't sound like my home people. I don't sound American. Who do I sound like? Although home, they think I sound American. They're like, oh, you're Yankin. Yeah. We say Yankin sound American. So, yeah. So there was that, the surface level accent thing. The other challenge I had was because I'm younger, so than the average PhD, I returned home when I was 28. So I had to adjust to people not knowing what to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you're younger than me. You can't tell me anything. But then I wasn't trying to tell you anything. It's as if people are just assumed by my presence or my questions that I was trying to assert my PhD-ness. But I wasn't doing that. You know, I just was trying to be regular. So part of it was trying to navigate this whole new title that I have.
Right.
And how do I interact with persons around me and be seen as normal, but still know a lot about my research area? Because that's the thing. We don't know much about probably astrophysics or whatnot. We know a lot about our research.
Exactly.
So it was.
How about professionally? Are you starting to carve out your own little, I think you said you're going to be starting your own business, or?
Yes. And after I finished school, everyone would ask, what are your plans? You know, what are you going to do? And I really couldn't honestly answer that question.
Yeah.
Usually, depending on who it was, I would make up something and say, you know, I would want to do this and that. But really and truly, I wasn't sure if that's where my passion was. But now I feel as though I have a sense of what I want to do. And it was part of the process. I had to go through a enlightenment type process where I didn't know what I wanted to do. I tried out different things. I networked with people. And then now I'm at a place where I see myself doing family life education and being a life coach and opening an online boutique.
Really?
Selling women's accessories. So handbags, sunglasses, and watches.
Outstanding.
Yeah. And, you know, people would hear that I'm starting a business and think, why are you doing an online clothing store? Your family studies. And for me, it's marrying my passion, all of them, and putting them in one. I like handbags, and I like accessories. Yeah. And I also enjoy online shopping. So I get to put those together. And I do recognize that the skills that I've learned while in the family studies program and in the marriage and family therapy program, as it relates to, say, dealing with people or human relations, that is huge when it comes to business, customer service, right?
Yep.
And so that training would help in that regard. And so what I've recognized in this life is just about doing what you're passionate about, using your experiences to inform how you get what you want to get done.
That's right. And I love it. And it's, as you know, I do a lot of entrepreneurial things. And
yes. And so we're talking.
Yes, exactly. So, and teach and train and consult with entrepreneurs. And so that steps out of, like, you know, sometimes I think people just like boxes, you know, so they know how to kind of figure you out. And when you step out of those boxes, it's a little jarring for people. And and I think, but I just love that you're doing that and doing what you want to do, and it doesn't mean you're abandoning anything. It's just, that's all informing what you're doing, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I didn't necessarily abandon therapy, because the funny thing is, people think, why aren't you sitting seeing clients? And they don't get that I'm still using my skills. I'm just not using it in the traditional way that you may think that it should be used.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So, well, good. Do you have a website now? Should we plug it?
My shameless plug. Yes. I'm not ready for it yet.
Okay.
So
okay.
We have to do part two, so I could do my shameless plug for that.
Yeah. You let me know when it launches, and I'll plug it. I promise I'll plug it on the podcast. Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Oh, I should add too, though, that I am attached to the UNDP, the United Nations Development Program. In Tobago, and that doing development work really helped me to just see the world from a broader perspective, but recognizing that family studies and marriage and family therapy, all this systemic thinking, is important even in development work.
Yeah. Okay, so Crystal, it's wonderful to hear your voice again and be able to spend some time talking to you, and it's been too long, so I just thank you for taking the time to chat and share yourself with our listeners. It's been a wonderful conversation.
It was indeed a pleasure. I'm so happy this happened, because I know with the time difference, it was a bit tough to you know, pin down, but yeah. I'm so thankful and grateful to you for the opportunity, and I hope that we could continue to collaborate and talk in the future.
Absolutely, so... Take care of yourself, Crystal, and best of luck in all the new endeavors.
Thank you, Chris, and I wish you all the best also with your health.
Thank you.
All right, then. Take care.
Well, that's our show, and I guess the moral of the story is, please, men, get out and get screened. And if you are a loved one of somebody, obviously from Dr. Clark's research, it probably would, these relationships are important, and maybe helping men get in and get screened, because early screening, like I said at the beginning of the show, has a profound impact on reversing the detrimental effects of prostate cancer. So I really appreciate Dr. Clark coming on the show. As always, thanks for listening. You can help us out by going to iTunes and rating and review the show. If you want a Radical Therapist sticker, please email me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Of course, we are on social media. We are at The Radical Therapist on Instagram, and we are at The Rad Therapist on Twitter. Please converse with us in any way you feel comfortable. Would love to hear from you and hear what you think of the show. So once again, thanks for listening. My name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist.